Accession number 28625 reel 5.
Other than that, and boots with jungle boots, canvas, a rubber sole. That's about it.
And had that all been issued at Redfern Barracks?
Yes.
And the level that you are now at, you know, you're quite up the career path, shall we say. Would you have had to hand back your other kit whilst you got the tropical one?
No. I'd moved just before, the week before we moved to Borneo. I left Headquarter Company and joined Alpha Company, which was a rifle company.
And was it a different role you were in?
Yes, slightly different, in that you were dealing with three platoons of fighting soldiers, as it were, rather than administrator.
So you were actually moving out of administration at this point?
Yes, and doing a similar job, being responsible for the discipline and the management and training.
And so were you one of the people who were now inspecting the other ones, like below you, shall we say?
Yes, you always had that aspect. You the sub-major is a fulcrum of a company. And he is responsible to the major who commands, and a captain who's the second in command. But he is the one who really leads the direction pointed out by the company commander, but is held responsible for the drill and the discipline. And if you've got a good company, some major, you've got a good company, which includes welfare too, and includes humour and all aspects of it.
And did you enjoy this move that you are getting out of administration?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, it was another rung on the ladder and allowed you the scope to perform in a trade that you were too happy to be in.
Okay. So once you arrived in Borneo, I know you'd been out in Malaya years before, but what were your first impressions of it?
That it hadn't changed. It was a very, very humid situation. I'd arrived there with a fairly bad cold and had been lucky to be accepted on the plane with the cold. So I was certainly suffering from a temperature. And seeing the jungle and the narrow road, the smell, everything was just normal jungle environment.
And how long had the flight lasted?
I think I don't know, about 23 hours or something like that. A long flight.
And was it the whole battalion that was out, or companies? Or
company at a time, just 100 odd in each plane, moving on a program.
Okay. And once you got, you know, once you landed there, did you have far to travel to go to the training camp?
No, when we arrived there, we were actually in the training camp, so you didn't have far to go to do your shooting and your jungle. I mean, there was jungle everywhere. In fact, I distinctly remember I could lie on my bed and look up at Kinabalu, that marvellous feature. But you didn't have far to travel. You could do it, you know, by using normal trucks.
And the training camp itself, can you describe that to us, please?
Well, it was a hutted camp with good latrines and shower facilities. You obviously had to leave your hut to get to these things, but generally speaking, it was a good camp, a dry camp.
And would you have been sharing your hut with anyone else?
With one.
And at the level you were at as well, did you have anyone who helped look after you? You know,
No.
So you still had to do all your own
work? Yes, quite independently, yes, mm-hmm. Throughout.
And had the British built this camp, or...?
The local engineers had done it. Obviously, the British system had rented it
And was it just this one company that were there? Or
no, the whole battalion.
And would there have been any other regiments?
No, no, we're quite on our own.
Okay. And what about food? Who provided the food there?
Well, we have our own system of drawing our rations, issued by the army systems. In situations like that, there are always people who have organised your move at different levels, different echelons, and you are aware as to whom you should go to get your requirements. You had your own cooks, your own butcher and baker, and you'd be self-sufficient.
And do you think they bought, like, any local produce as well, you know?
Oh, I'm sure we did. Yes, yes. All the fruit and vegetables was available there. The army system would negotiate contracts with people who provide fish, beef, chicken, and such like things, vegetables and fruit. And they would be to a specific standard. And, yes, we were well fed.
And in a place like that as well, because you had your own cooks and, as you say, these contracts as well, was it generally the same type of food that you were getting, whether you were maybe back in Edinburgh or...?
As near as possible, yes.
I was wondering if there was any influences from outside, you know, like any local influences?
Well, curry and rice seemed to feed you. It was something that was introduced and then you acquired a taste for it. So that would be part of the choice of the menu, say, once a week, for example.
And who selected the menu? Would it have been the cooks or the men?
No, the cooks would do it. They're all experts in their own way. And as a quartermaster, you would be in charge of the financial running of it. And you'd have the various departments under you. And you were given allowances for the amount of men you had, and everything was audited and scrutinised. It had to be balanced, and it was always carefully done. It's always been a very important aspect of life in the government. If you feed them well, they'll respond to you.
And was the food generally of a high standard?
Oh, yes, yes.
Did they ever moan about it?
Well, moaning is healthy, and without reason sometimes. I distinctly remember we used to conduct monthly mess meetings in which one representative from each department would come along and voice his criticism, the complaints, etc. And I remember I was looking after young soldiers at this particular time, and this lad from Glasgow said that it was monotonous breakfast. And I said, well, you get this and that and the next thing, and we'll poach the egg, we'll fry as long as you've got patience to wait, and we'll even do the fish and milk and whatever. And he said it was boring, and I said, well, what do you get to eat at home? And he said, tea and toast. So that's typical Jock attitude to it. If he came up with a very good constructive criticism, then obviously we'll look into it. And Mr. Dossett would also look at the men's plates that they came in before going to the soil. Never too much food in it, then it meant that the food wasn't good and the man was taking too much. So it was all balanced.
So it was scrutinised.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And down at this training camp, was there any threat of, enemy fire or anything?
No, nothing.
Okay. And what were you doing at the training camp for the month then?
Just patrolling and walking in the jungle, carrying your equipment, sweating profusely, drinking gallons of water, preparing makeshift camps that you would do in a jungle, stage overnight, etc., and doing certain tactical movements that you would probably be engaged in. Training to be a quiet, effective, movable object.
Okay. And You spoke there about sweating. Did you get any supplements that maybe would have helped with excess sweat or anything?
With salt tablets that we'd be encouraged to put into a water bottle or just dilute them in a cup of water or chew them if you could do that. But obviously you had only one water bottle, so you had to make quite sure that that lasted a particular period, because you couldn't guarantee replenishment. And when you did do so, you had tablets in which you purify the water once you did it. And that's a horrid tasting thing to do.
And was the water not safe to drink out there?
The deeper into the jungle, the more clearer and better it was. But if you were on the fringes, then you were perhaps affected by the villagers who lived there, and they didn't have runaways the same as what we have.
And I've never had a salt tablet, so when you take it either in water or chew it or whatever, does it taste as salt?
No doubt about that. You chew it and it's immediately effective. It's difficult to chew it. But you can drink it, but you're not quenching your thirst. You're merely replacing the salt that you've lost.
So it is like maybe just having salt. Does it kind of taste like that?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Okay. And of course, lots of people can't take it and it makes people sick. But if you've got a situation, if we have somebody A who doesn't sweat, or B cannot take a salt tablet, then you've got problems. You would try and encourage people to drink perhaps when they don't want to or can't.
And were you okay with the salt tablets?
Yes, I had no problem.
And you said there about the water bottle as well. Uh-huh. What would have been the capacity of the water bottle?
A pint and a half.
And had that to last you the whole day?
Sometimes, but you always looked for what was aware of what you should be doing. And in those days, they didn't encourage you to drink so much water as they do now. The present belief is that you should drink as much as you wish. And the day when I was a younger soldier, it was water was a controlled system. For instance, in Cyprus, it was a water discipline, and you only drank when the company commander said you should do. And that was perhaps just a couple of sips from the cap of the bottle, because there's no water available. So it made sense, but against the physical requirement, which is now very much more in evidence, and you see soldiers, whatever they are, with bottles and issued water and whatever. So from that point of view, the army has moved on.
And did you find this difficult, you know, having this controlled drinking, if you like?
Yes. Mm-hmm. On reflection now, I mean, it's a horrendous thing that you could imagine moving at night, and everything was deathly quiet when you stopped, and it was a metal container, and you could hear the top being squeaked, and here and there as somebody tried to cheat, and instantly you could pick out the poor individual who were desperate.
You raised a good point there. I was just actually thinking of a plastic bottle like we do now.
They have a more a rubber top now, but in those days it was metal.
And what would happen, you know, to that person who was, you know, found trying to have a sly drink, shall we say?
He would be charged and punished for failing to comply. All part of discipline.
What type of discipline? Or what would they have him doing? You know,
it depends where you are. I mean, he'd perhaps be fined a sum of money or given an extra fatigue to do something that make them remember that you have to have discipline.
So even out in this training camp, you could have been disciplined for maybe having some extra water?
No, we were slightly different. Mm-hmm. That's 64. I'm more relating to 1956 in Cyprus.
Okay, sorry.
Mm-hmm. So there's no visible water in Cyprus. Very, very few bits in the winter period. Whereas in the jungle, it was okay.
In the jungle, was there streams? You know, I could imagine, was it a high canopy that the jungle had, or, you know, was it?
Yes, there was a high canopy, but there were many, many streams. Well, each valley, for instance, is greater, and you were in there behind one, and when you found a good one, I mean, the water was lovely, but you obviously had to consider health, generally. And it would only take one little mistake to ruin man's health, and deep in the jungle, one man falls, then you have to use four to carry him, so you lose five, and then the four get relieved and so on. So there's a relationship there that must be understood.
Okay, but whilst you were in the training camp, was it easy to obtain water? Was it just...
Oh yes, no restriction.
So there was like maybe a pipe system or something?
Yes, yeah. They had a proper system and the big header tank, and there's no restriction.
Okay, and what type of equipment as well would you have had at the training camp?
Just the same as we would have anywhere else. Other than, you know, your boots were different and your suits were different, i.e. they were tropical.
And would you have still had, I know you were, did you take your rifle and that out with you?
Yes.
And what about things like, you know, in fighting situations before that, maybe entrenching tools and that, did you have any of that?
You would certainly take one per platoon, one entrenching tool.
And did you ever have to dig ditches or anything?
No. You would get rid of your refuge and the latrine, for example.
And was that old dug? Was that?
Yes, you'd do that yourself. And obviously you'd dig it deep.
Okay. And who was doing the training? Was it the British Army who were training you for this?
We were training ourselves predominantly because we'd sent people in advance to the different courses, so that by the time we arrived, this nucleus, with much more experience than us, would put us through set scenes and lecture us and accompany us and just point out, just basically train us up to the same standard as they were at.
Okay. And you spoke about, you know, you were also at the training camp, but learning how to prepare the camps and that when you went out into the jungle.
No, we would do that when we went into the jungle. For example, at the fringe of the jungle, on a daytime sort of training, we would set up a camp, and then we would do it properly rather than when we went out into the jungle for 3, 4, 5, 6 days.
Okay. And how would you go about setting up this camp?
Well, you would make sure it was on an elevation where necessary, near water, and you're able to view as much as you possibly could. I mean, you wouldn't be in a valley, but you'd be in a bit of a hill, and you would have it in a circle. You'd use the vines from the trees in lieu of rope to tie your perimeter, so that when it's dark at night, difficult to see, you would clear a path which the damp barks and things become luminous, and you would clear that round the vine so that if you moved at night, I go on central duty and things like that, you could just hang on to the vine and walk round to where the particular position of the sentry was. And each of your tents or bashes would be facing out.
And this will take a while to organise, you know.
The more often you do it, the better you become. The more often you do it, are made aware of a situation and are corrected, then the better you become. And eventually, you're in a situation where a good platoon was full of telepathy. And it's amazing how by hand signals and shape of your lips or a nod of your eye, etc., you could convey to somebody what you wanted. And it's essential to move as quietly as you possibly could. If you do make a noise, I did dank, it is damp, it is wet, and if you were crushing through the undergrowth or cutting it with your forearm, then you've got to be aware that, you know, people will hear you.
And was it the type of thing when, obviously, you were training, and then when she did make a camp later on, was it the type of thing that you would do on a daily basis, or would you use this camp for a few days?
If circumstances would dictate, if you went deep into the jungle, you made a camp, and then you would offer different points, and that might last for 3 days, for instance. But if you were just beetling through the jungle, as it were, you'd have a separate temporary camp every night.
So you could organise this in quite a short period?
Yes. I mean, you took time to cut the branches to allow you to secure them to a tree or something, and then put down your ground sheet. But some nights you didn't have time to do that, and you just spread your ground sheet on the ground and crawled into it, because it was dark at 6 at night and dark at 6 in the morning. It didn't come light until 6 in the morning.
Okay, and being in the jungle as well, you know, training and then eventually when you were there, was there ever occasions when maybe the wildlife would make a noise when you were trying to do this? Would they highlight that you were trying?
Yeah, very often, monkeys in particular. And they made a very sensitive hearing, and you could hear them from some distance away. The noise in the jungle is incredible, quite incredible.
Okay, and did you see the monkeys and things?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did they ever attack or anything?
No. The nearest we got was a little baby monkey that had been left by its mother, dropped by its mother, perhaps as we'd surprised it. And they were up above, waiting to see, obviously, if we would touch it. But obviously, if we touched it, then the sense would change, we might put them on off. In this instance, it didn't. And we later, from a distance, saw the mum collect little baby.
And had you been warned of situations like that? You know, was this part of your training? Like, now they tell you things like that, even with wildlife programs, you know, don't touch the young birds or something. Do you think you've been told about that?
It must have been told. I mean, it was just funny. But as you chat, a situation develops and somebody comes up with an answer or a suggestion, and we responded.
Okay, and when we're speaking about monkeys and birds and things, was there anything threatening in the jungle, like snakes or spiders?
Oh, yes, snakes, certainly. I distinctly remember one being pulled viciously from my basha in the early hours of the morning by the feet, because there was some small snake which had been hovering, poised near where my head had been. And that certainly woke me up. I remember doing a patrol with Gurkhas, and we found a snake which had obviously had a wild pig or something huge inside its tummy, lying, sleeping, and obviously enjoying the meal. And the Gurkhas were keen to dispose of the snake, but we were more keen to move on, I think.
And was it another soldier who had pulled you out?
Oh, yes, two soldiers.
And so did you actually see the snake yourself?
Yes. Yes, there were, generally speaking, plenty of snakes, but you ignored them, which was the best answer.
So, if you ignored them, did they generally ignore you?
Mm.
Were there any of them, do you think, that could have been poisonous or anything?
Mm, probably. I didn't make a study of them.
Okay. And what about insects? You know, had you been careful about bites?
Yeah. Bites, yes. Now, mosquitoes in abundance, rather like the midge in Scotland, and wherever you were, they would come along, and if you didn't hear them, you know, the female apparently was the worst offender to inject whatever she did into you, which would, if you didn't look after it, would become septic. You had leeches, for example, they were perhaps equally as disturbing. They would comes from the ground or from the branches of your clothing, quietly, effectively climbing, nose and tail, and pierce your skin and suck your blood. And depending on the type of leech, you could take quite a bit out. But then you had to try and get them off. And the quickest way was to use a cigarette and you touch it, which would allow it to remove the head from inside your skin, and you'd flick it off and kill it. And that was difficult, because again, it would leave a puncture in your skin, which, you know, you could hardly keep clean under the circumstances. But nobody escaped leeches every day, every night.
And did you feel them, you know?
Only when they got the stage of the blood being sucked, but generally speaking, you didn't.
And was it sore?
Eventually, you know, you had a potentially septic situation, and obviously, if you moved in the jungle, your dirty hand, dirty nail, everything was relative, and you tried to be sensible about it.
And so, how did you try and keep it clean?
You had a medical pack in the platoon, and you had certain iodines and lotions such as that that you'd dab on it. Each man had his own foot powder, for example, and his insect repellent. He just hoped and prayed.
And when you mentioned something like foot powder, were the men's feet checked on a regular basis or anything?
Yes, you had to, for instance, you had two sets of clothing when you went out. You had the working set, which was invariably wet, saturated in half an hour, and your sock and your boots. And in your bedroll, inside your waterproof, you have a lightweight blanket and a dry suit of clothing, including socks and gym shoes, including so. And at night time, you put that on, and then you just hung your wet stuff outside, put your boots upside down on a stick to drain them and put them up. And then in the morning, after you stood down, you would get into your wet suit, pack up your dry suit, and that was you for the day. So that was, you know, a warm body in cold, wet clothing. It could be difficult sometimes.
And you mentioned their socks as well. Were they cotton socks or something?
Well, wool and polystyrene was a mixture.
Were they not hot on your feet?
Not really. No, your foot was soaked every day. So they were sort of drawn and very pale in colour. But if you weren't suffering from blisters and such and things like that, you managed all right. I say you had your foot powder, and at night time you were quite sure you used that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned as well, was it bashers?
Yes.
What is that?
Basher is Malaysian for hut, i.e. what we made with, maybe better described as a wee tent, an open-sided tent, which was a fringe over a pole or a stick which we tied to two upright trees and then sloped down. So that you could sit and look out. And as I mentioned, we were on a perimeter. Everybody looked out. Everybody was in a defensive mode. And that was a basher.
But this covering that you put over, like the stick, was that like of tent material or something?
Yeah, waterproof. Just a waterproof that you could put over your head, like a poncho. And you only had, as I say, a fringe bit, a couple of feet on the one side, but the bulk of it down on the other side.
And for protection in the jungle as well, was this sufficient? Did you get rains or anything there?
Yes. I mean, we never wore a waterproof cover. You couldn't possibly do that and remain alert and able to engage on anything. So, as I mentioned, you're saturated within half an hour, whether that be rain or sweat or whatever. And you just stayed like that. And the monsoon rains are incredible, quite incredible. Between the thunder and the lightning and the rain and being in the jungle, it's incredible, really. Sometimes, if you're up in the hills, you'd think, my goodness, the world's going to collapse.